It's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. ربكم الله الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية ادعوا ربكم تضرعا إنه لا يحب المعتدين. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our headlines. Turkey accuses the Kurdistan Workers' Party, PKK, of being behind a bomb attack on a major Istanbul street that left six people dead and scores of others wounded. The U.S., South Korea, and Japan vow a strong response in case of a seventh nuclear test by North Korea amid tensions following the recent drills between Washington and Seoul. And Ukraine's president says fighting in the eastern Donetsk region continues unabated, with no let-up in Russian attacks. Hello and welcome. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. Latest on the deadly bomb attack in Turkey's Istanbul, the Interior Ministry says police have detained 22 suspects, including the woman who planted the bomb. The ministry is blaming militants of the Kurdish Workers' Party for the blast, saying the order for the attack was given in Kobane. That's a city in northern Syria where Turkish forces have carried out operations against the Kurdish militants in recent years. There's been no claim of responsibility yet. The attack left at least six people dead and more than 80 others wounded. The blast occurred on the busy Istiklal Street in Taksim area, which is popular with locals and tourists. Istanbul and other Turkish cities have in the past been targeted by Kurdish separatists and Daesh terrorists. Our Istanbul correspondent, Roshan Saglam, joined us earlier with more on the potential culprits behind the explosion.
But he also said that the officials were able to know that a woman was the one who placed the explosive device in Istiklal Street, where the bombing took place. And he said that they were able to know the perpetrators and they will reveal information very soon. He also said that we will not allow those terrorists to reach their goals in Turkey, and we will be able to make this nation safe again. Right before Erdogan was speaking, we heard gunshots in an area that is very close to Istiklal Street. It's called Shishhana. It is exactly where actually Press TV office is. The gunshots were heard for like a few minutes, and the police was in the area. So I think that probably this could be like maybe they could be following the suspects. And since they revealed that the suspect was a woman, I think that is most likely that those perpetrators behind what happened today is the Kurdistan Workers Party, PKK, because as we all know that Kurdistan Workers Party is known that mainly the suicide bombers, the fighters in it, half of them is females. So they're mainly women, and a lot of them have been involved in explosions or attacks that took place inside Istanbul.
The U.S. president says his country, Japan, and South Korea have never been more aligned in their stance against North Korea and its missile tests.
Japan and the Republic of Korea are both critical allies of the United States. And for years, our countries have been engaged in a trilateral cooperation out of a shared concern for the nuclear and missile threats of North Korea poses to our people. And North Korea continues provocation for provocative behavior. This partnership is even more important than it's ever been.
Biden, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, and South Korean President Yoon Suk Yeol issued a joint statement condemning the recent missile tests by North Korea. The trio met on the sidelines of an East Asian summit in the Cambodian capital. The three leaders vowed a quote strong and resolute response in case of a seventh nuclear test. Over the past week, North Korea has fired a barrage of missiles in response to Washington and Seoul, carrying out the largest ever air drills on the peninsula. Pyongyang considers the military exercises as a rehearsal for an invasion. The U.S. and South Korea, however, say they are holding the drills in response to the North's possible plan to resume nuclear tests. The Ukrainian president says investigations have revealed that Russian troops committed hundreds of war crimes in Ukraine's Kherson region.
Investigators have already documented more than 400 Russian war crimes. Bodies of both civilians and military are being found. In the Kherson region, the Russian army left the same savagery behind as in other regions of our country, which it managed to invade. We will find and bring to justice every murderer without any doubts.
Zelensky stated that law and order have been restored in many areas in Kherson, where the hunt, as he said, was on for Russian soldiers and mercenaries. Meanwhile, he added that fighting in the eastern Donetsk region is as intense as it had been in recent days, with no let-up in Russian attacks. Zelensky also said Ukrainian forces' resilience and courage are at their highest level as they confront Russian troops. He said the Ukrainian military will not allow Russian forces to penetrate Ukrainian defenses. In Spain, hundreds of thousands of people marched through central Madrid to protest against the regional government's healthcare policy. They say the policy is destroying primary healthcare. Trade unions, healthcare workers, and left-wing politicians were among those marching. Organizers say the regional government's cuts in funding and staff have increased waiting lists and prompted layoffs and job uncertainty. They say Madrid spends the least on primary healthcare despite being Spain's richest region. Local authorities say there were upwards of 200,000 people at a protest, but organizers put the figure at over 600,000. Turning now to the occupied West Bank, where Israeli atrocities show no sign of abating. The regime forces have killed yet another Palestinian in western Ramallah. Troopers shot dead the Palestinian woman in the town of Beitounia. It happened as they opened fire on a car the victim was riding in. Other passengers of the vehicle have been arrested. The Israeli military also separately arrested 9 people in raids across the occupied West Bank. The regime has recently intensified its deadly crackdown in the region. The campaign has left more than 140 Palestinians dead this year alone. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, is with us right now for more on that story. Mona, it's good to talk to you. Tell us more.
And no Palestinian was killed by the Israeli soldiers early on Monday. It's not clear why the Israelis killed this Palestinian young lady. What happened, according to a video that showed a Palestinian vehicle driving in the city of Beitounia, West Ramallah. Israeli forces have already raided Beitounia city, and when they saw the vehicle there, they opened fire at the vehicle, killing the Palestinian girl. And they claimed that there were two inside the vehicle and they arrested them. It's not clear if that's true, if the two who were arrested were inside the vehicle or not. But we know that a Palestinian, a female Palestinian, was shot dead. According to paramedics, she could be 19 or 20 years old. The identity of this girl is not known yet. She was transferred to Palestinian hospital in Ramallah. The Israeli forces have already raided several areas across the occupied West Bank and arrested a number of Palestinians. The Israelis had issued a statement claiming that early morning, Israeli soldiers were surprised by a Palestinian vehicle approaching the forces who stormed Bitunia City, and that's why the soldiers opened fire. But according to the video, it was clear that the vehicle didn't even approach the raiding soldiers. They themselves who opened fire at the corner.
Mona, has there been any reaction from resistance front?
Well, every time a Palestinian is killed by the Israeli forces, Palestinian resistance groups issue statements, of course, saying that this would be the natural response for the ongoing and non-stop Israeli crimes against Palestinians. The response should be at least ongoing resistance in different forms, because on daily basis, Israeli troops raid Palestinian areas, arrest people, open fire at people, and kill them in cold blood. Israeli forces, protecting the settler, they attack people and they confiscate their land. So the natural response, according to the different political and Islamic and national Palestinian resistance groups, would be the ongoing activities, the non-stop resistance acts against the Israelis.
Thank you so much, Mona. Stay safe, please. Mona Kandil, our correspondent in Ramallah. Moving on, Israel has carried out a deadly missile strike against Syrian military positions in the country's central province of Homs. Syrian media say two soldiers were killed in the latest aggression targeting the Shayirat airbase southeast of Homs. Three others were also injured. According to Syrian media, the country's air defense systems intercepted most of the missiles. The Israeli regime frequently launches missile attacks inside Syria, but rarely claims responsibility. The attacks mainly target the Syrian military, as well as resistance fighters battling foreign-backed terrorists. Damascus has repeatedly complained to the United Nations about Israel's raids, calling for international action and condemnation of the violation of its sovereignty and territorial integrity. Another U.S. citizen has been arrested in Saudi Arabia after getting into a dispute with security officials while performing the Hajj pilgrimage. Mohammed Salem, an American of Yemeni origin, was taken into custody in Mecca on November 1st for making remarks critical of the monarchy. The 63-year-old has been transferred to a maximum security facility typically used for high-profile political prisoners and suspected terrorists. There is no information whether the man has been charged. Last month, another U.S. citizen of Saudi origin was sentenced to 16 years in prison. That apparently because of his Twitter posts on topics including the war in Yemen and the 2018 killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Bahrainis have voted in parliamentary elections. This may sound like a very positive development, but nothing could be further from the truth. For how could there be a free and fair election when all the opposition groups have been disbanded or crushed? Since 2011, the Bahraini uprising began and hasn't stopped till this day.
Bahrain has held its general elections. The regime was delighted. Authorities in the Sunni-ruled state, which crushed a 2011 anti-government uprising, said that the vote was free and put the turnout at 73%. But the vote was anything but free and fair. Rights groups called the voting environment of what is supposed to be a democratic process as political repression. They said there were highly restrictive measures that barred members of banned opposition groups. They added holding this general election will not address the atmosphere of repression and the denial of human rights that has gripped Bahrain for years. This in essence would make the vote a sham, that it would be void of holding any value. It was no surprise that Bahrainis took to the streets to protest the electoral process and announced that they would boycott the election, since it served the political trajectory of the ruling class. Bahrain experienced an uprising in 2011, still ongoing till this day, in which the Bahraini regime dissolved the main opposition groups and cracked down on dissent. The regime's crackdown over the past 12 years has been brutal. According to a 61-page report, the court is satisfied with the confession. Bahrain death sentences follow torture, sham trials. The regime has arbitrarily arrested more than 20,000 and tortured more than 6,000 victims. This also includes extrajudicial killings of more than 200 and political death sentences, the dissolution of opposition political societies, and the demolition of 38 mosques. And this is happening in a Persian Gulf country that is a key ally of the U.S. in the region, home to the U.S.'s Navy's Fifth Fleet, and also the United Kingdom, which opened a permanent military base in 2018.
The Bahraini regime's suppression of its Shia citizens and stripping them of their rights, in addition to the jailing and torturing of the opposition members, forced the regime to make a major decision. In October of this year, it withdrew from the Human Rights Council, which was one more nail in the coffin of its commitment to protecting human rights. Government critics saw that as a sign that since it was no longer a member, it would feel free to continue its crackdown.
The powerful Shia cleric Shariza Qassem has said that the election means normalization. He said the elections constitute a test of the populace's awareness, explaining that to elect means opening the door for Bahraini citizenship-bearing Israelis to vote for parliament members. This would translate into how the electorate, meaning soldiers, dual citizens, security forces, those with personal interests in mind, and normalization advocates, would create a parliament for the government and not the people. The double standard approach by the UK and the US stands out when it comes to the issue of human rights and Bahrain. After all, Bahraini courts have convicted and sentenced defendants to death following manifestly unfair trials based solely or primarily on confessions allegedly coerced through torture and ill treatment. The governments of the US and the UK, as well as the European Union and its member states, should urge Bahrain, through both public and diplomatic channels, to halt all executions and to seriously investigate torture allegations and violations of the right to a fair trial. Yet they have chosen to do that with other countries, for example, Iran, which ironically has rioters out on the streets, endangering Iran's national security. According to Iran's intelligence minister, both the US and the UK even have a hand in the deadly protests, like to the CIA. A recent visit of the Pope to Bahrain posed an opportunity for the plight of Bahrainis to be addressed. 130 human rights organizations appealed to the Pope of the Vatican to demand the release of prisoners of conscience in Bahrain. They asked them to adopt an initiative urging the Bahraini authorities to end violations. But those hopes are dim. These 130 human rights organizations have cited how so many Bahrainis have faced discrimination, jail time, and torture. Yet Bahrain has always shifted the blame to Iran for the unrest. Could 130 human rights organizations be wrong, or for them to be lying? But Bahrain ultimately cannot have a democratic process because its big brother Saudi Arabia, which is just a stone's throw away, will be threatened by democracy taking place next door and will vehemently reject this, since it cannot risk having democracy creep into the kingdom. After all, Bahrain is joined only by a causeway to Saudi Arabia.
And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The all-merciful, the all-compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
In the limelight. While the U.S. regime baselessly accuses other countries of vote rigging, this regime itself has the most undemocratic and unhealthy election in the world. The U.S. has lost face, and American officials cannot hide this issue from the eyes of the world by simply putting a makeup on the face of their politics in their Zionist-controlled media. In this regard, we have provided different media views on this issue. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Global Times wrote, voting for U.S. 2022 midterm elections began officially on November 8, and the elections were more closely contested than public opinion had previously expected. This is an internal U.S. matter, and the outside world has limited interest in its process and results. Nevertheless, the elections have sparked widespread concerns in the international community. To use an analogy, it is like seeing a group fight not far from your home, and you may be hit by a brick thrown out suddenly. Globalization has broken the distance of time and space. In the past 2 years, the destructive spillover effects of the U.S. domestic chaos on the international situation have become increasingly obvious, creating too many troubles. According to the original design of the system, the midterm elections were originally a midterm exam of the ruling party's 2-year performance, and the exam questions were mainly about the domestic economy and people's livelihoods. This time, however, the elections were off-topic from the beginning, with the Republican Party still obsessed about whether the result of the presidential election 2 years ago was fair, while the Democratic Party repeatedly made the election a referendum on American democracy. The American people are suffering from the worst inflation in 4 decades and fears of a recession, but their concerns have been diluted. The two parties have tried their best to incite the kidnap voters with ideological language, which further exacerbates the uncertainty and destructiveness of the elections. U.S. allies are concerned that the changing political landscape in Washington may lead to a reversal of their foreign strategies and public policies. At present, political views of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party on major international issues, such as the Russia-Ukraine crisis and climate change, are distinct, and the relevant decisions made by different parties or even by different people from the same party are vastly different. They do not have to, nor want to consider the stability and continuity of policies. They not only have no psychological burden when overturning the decisions of their predecessors, but often feel smug. The world has witnessed this kind of manipulation many times, such as U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Agreement, Iran nuclear talks, arms control talks, and related UN agencies. The division of American society and the opposition of political parties have evolved into overall untrustworthiness and capriciousness of the U.S. in international arena. U.S. political system has made policymakers less accountable for irresponsible behaviors. Countries that are regarded as rivals by the U.S. don't expect the rotation of U.S. political parties to smooth ties or bring the U.S. back to pragmatism and rationality. In other words, they hold no illusions. At the same time, these countries are mentally prepared for the possibility that they may become the targets of the U.S. to vent its strong emotions. Ironically, the U.S. has displayed a negative type of certainty in this regard. It has become the biggest source of global instability. It is making the global situation worse by both uncertainties and certainty. Being highly sensitive, capricious, neurotic, and aggressive are all recent symptoms of American democracy. Since the U.S. is a superpower with global influence, when its system is sick, the whole world is inflicted. From the Capitol riot, which shocked the world, to the midterm elections, U.S. domestic political turmoil is still going on after 2 years. The risk of political violence is growing rather than decreasing. Crime rate is going up. Post on Twitter that mentioned civil war had soared nearly 3,000%. Politicians are competing for who is more aggressive. Not only ordinary Americans are frustrated and anxious about the situation, but the world is also worried about the U.S. A French media outlet asked recently, "Is the American powder keg in danger of exploding?" It shows the outside world's common feeling. The world has another consensus. U.S. political environment will further deteriorate after midterm elections. The U.S. democratic system has been in operation for more than 200 years. Objectively speaking, this alone can be regarded as remarkable. However, practices show that human society has not yet designed a set of perfect political system that can be well applied anywhere once and for all. In other words, there has never been the myth of democracy, nor should people defy American political system. American democracy has come to where it is today, with increasingly obvious drawbacks. To some extent, this is inevitable. American democracy also needs to keep pace with the time. It is worth mentioning that as the quality of American democracy is declining, its cost is soaring. The total cost of 2022 state and federal midterm elections is projected to exceed $16.7 billion. No wonder it's been referred to as the most expensive midterms ever. We have always avoided commenting on the specific details of the U.S. midterm elections. To be honest, this is out of concerns that the U.S. might rascally put the blame on people, accusing them for interfering in U.S. internal affairs. The truth is, countries which have suffered from U.S. interference is their home affairs have no intent, will not, and cannot intervene in U.S. domestic politics. But U.S. politics affects the interest of the whole world. People sincerely hope that the U.S. will settle down as soon as possible. Common Dreams also wrote, regardless of how the races for congressional seats shake out when the vote tallies conclude, the majority of Congress GOP caucus will still be made up of 2020 election deniers. The midterms have largely gone off without much of a hitch, but election deniers and those seeking to suppress the votes of opponents have proven they won't take that sitting down. Regardless of how the races for congressional seats shake out, when the vote tallies conclude, the majority of Congress GOP caucus will still be made up of 2020 election deniers. The recent election lacked the widespread protests, major disruptions, rampant voter intimidation, or even violence that some feared would unfold at the polls. But don't think the threat of voter suppression is over. It's just getting started for this election as well as for 2024. Florida is a case study for how it will be done. If the re-election of Governor Ron DeSantis, one of the most high-profile embracers of 2020 election denialism, wasn't enough to spare fear the efforts to upend the elections will continue, then his move to block federal election monitors from entering polling places in the Sunshine State should. The Department of Justice dispatched monitors to 64 election districts in 24 states, including Broward, Miami-Dade, and Palm Beach counties in Florida to ensure compliance with the federal voting laws. 8 Massachusetts communities were also included in that monitoring. It's nothing new. Federal officials have monitored elections since the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965. But in Florida, as well as in Missouri, Republican state officials refused to let monitors inside polling places, citing a state law. But federal law trumps state law. Still, given the Supreme Court's decade-long effort to pull every tooth out of the Voting Rights Act's enforcement powers, DeSantis and others are more emboldened to flout that law than ever. Just consider how successfully he and the Florida GOP gerrymandered election districts to dilute Black Floridans' voting power. There were some signs of more traditional voter suppression efforts this week, like in Texas, where Black voters were shadowed or asked to say their addresses aloud even after they were checked in by polling officials, a move some voters said put them in fear of retaliation. It took an emergency legal challenge by a local NAACP chapter and resulting court order to allow voters to cast their ballots without interference. But it was clear even before the polls opened that the main voter suppression tools of choice would be baseless legal claims and disinformation. It began weeks ago when many of the same voting districts that proved pivotal in the 2020 presidential election and were subsequently targeted by Donald Trump and other election-denying Republicans were the subject to more frivolous challenges. In Michigan, a ham-handed effort by GOP Secretary of State candidate Christina Caramo to stop absentee ballots that were not obtained in person from being counted, but wait for all, only in Detroit was tossed out of the court before Election Day. But according to New York Times report, another more organized effort by GOP officials, activists, and lawyers in that state has been underway for months. With the aid of people like Celta Mitchell, known for being a central player in Trump's plan to interfere with the 2020 election in Georgia. While similar GOP legal attacks on balloting in Philadelphia didn't prevent biggest statewide wins for Democratic in Pennsylvania, officials there still worry that it will be enough to plant seeds of doubt to sow groundless allegations of election fraud.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how the Democratic Secular Republic of India has in recent years under the BJP government transformed into a Hindu majoritarian state. And we shall also look at attempts being made by right-wing forces in India at the behest of the Hindu nationalist government to convert mosques into Hindu temples.
The democratic, multicultural, and secular Republic of India is gradually being transformed into a Hindu supremacist state with a rapid shift towards majoritarianism and communal polarization. During the 8-year Bharatiya Janata Party rule, religious intolerance has become more pronounced in the country. One of the searing indictments of the Narendra Modi government's anti-Muslim bias is the Bilkis Banu case, a Muslim woman who was gang-raped by a Hindu mob after 14 members of her family were killed. The rapists were scandalously released on India's Independence Day recently.
The report card of the Hindu nationalist BJP government's 8-year rule in India presents a grim picture. While the period has been defined by divisive politics and anti-Muslim violence, one particular incident that has become the emblem of the Hindu majoritarian politics of the ruling party is the Bilkis Banu case. Her lonely fight for justice dates back to 2002, when the western Indian state of Gujarat saw the worst state-sponsored massacre in post-partition history. Hindu mobs torched Muslim homes and businesses. Modi was the chief minister of Gujarat at the time, and an inquiry found him responsible for the pogrom that killed more than 1,000 people, including Banu's family. Her 3-year-old daughter was smashed on the ground, according to court documents. She was brutally gang-raped and survived with those scars. In 2008, following a high-profile trial, 11 men were sentenced to life in prison for rape and murder. Many thought that justice had been done finally. But this August, the state government granted them remission under a controversial provision in India's criminal law that allows prisoners to be freed once they serve 14 years. The ruling proved once again that the fight for justice never ends in BJP-ruled India.
When India broke the shackles of British imperialism in 1947, after centuries of struggle, its founding fathers envisioned a secular, democratic, multicultural republic. Over the years, the world's second most populous country also emerged as one of the world's fastest growing economies. However, the slide into majoritarianism began less than a decade ago when the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party rose to power under the leadership of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. BJP's meteoric rise has seen the gradual erosion of human rights in the country.
The ruling Bharatiya Janata Party has used the toxic political ideology of Hindutva as its trump card since it first came into being in the late 1980s. However, since the party's second coming under Narendra Modi in 2014, BJP has aggressively promoted Hindutva, which human rights activists believe is primarily centered on divisive politics, communal polarization, and hate. The ruling party has also used it as its prime election strategy in general and state-level elections in recent years, reaping rich dividends. While other political parties, including the Congress with largely secular leanings, have been consigned to oblivion. Hindus constitute the overwhelming majority of India's 1.4 billion population, with Muslims making up around 14%. In recent years, emboldened by the Hindu Nationalist Party's pro-Hindutva slant, right-wing groups have intensified the chorus to declare India a Hindu state, where Muslims and other minorities would be second-class students. It has further alienated Muslims and fueled hate and violence against them. Controversial moves by the Modi government, such as the 2019 Citizenship Amendment Act, the revocation of Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in 2019, Delhi's anti-Muslim riots in 2020, and more recently, ban on hijab in schools and use of bulldozers to demolish Muslim homes and businesses, have been seen as collective punishment for Muslims.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Asif Mojtaba, the founder of Miles to Smile Foundation. Mr. Mojtaba, welcome to the program, sir. Now, how did the secular multicultural republic of India, as envisioned by its founding fathers, transform into a Hindu supremacist state known for its majoritarianism?
This is one basic question that people often ask, that how easy it became for the Hindutva nationalists to transform the multicultural, multilinguistic, secular country like India into the pathway of a Hindu republic. So like an old saying that Rome wasn't built a day, this road to Islamophobia, this road to hate, and this road to Hindutva chauvinism wasn't built a day, right? So it was created right after the independence of India in 1947. From 1947 till 2014, see, 2014 is the year when the Hindu Nationalist Party, BJP, came to power. People often consider it as a pivot, as a starting point, as a fulcrum from where the oppression and demeaning and lynching of Muslims started. But as a matter of fact, if you look back 70 years from the independence, there has been numerous instances of mob lynching. There has been numerous instances of riots and pogroms. There was a major... In the same month, there was a Sikh genocide that occurred. Similarly, there was a Nilai massacre, 1983. There was a Bhagalpur massacre, 1989. There was Malyana, Meerut, Hashimpura. So I could count numerous occasions when the riot happened. And when these riots or pogroms or genocides were happening, the Congress, the party which considered itself to be a champion of secularism in the country, the party who considered it that they gave the word secularism to the constitution that wasn't there. So this party was in power. And despite being in power, they did nothing to stop the rise of Hindu nationalist groups like the RSS.
Mr. Mojtaba, we could say that the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party has successfully used anti-Muslim violence as an effective election strategy in recent years. So what does that tell about the largest democracy's electorate?
So if you talk about how easily the BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, rose into electoral prominence using anti-Muslim hatred and riding the Hindutva wave. So I would say, like, see, BJP is one political party. Similarly, Congress is one political party. Samajwadi is one political party. And there are numerous political parties. Every political party has some political ideology that is to win the electoral seats. So winning the electoral seats in majority, forming the government at the center or at the state level, these are the ideological of all the parties. So to gain to power, these political parties adhere to numerous other ideologies. So and similarly, there is one Hindutva that is religious ideology. I would say Hindutva is a fanatic religious ideology that considers like non-Abrahamical religion. I mean, very sharp difference between Abrahamical and non-Abrahamical religion. They have a sharp distinction between the religion of the soil, like Hinduism, Sikhism, and Buddhism, Jainism, and the other foreign religion, like alien religion, like Islam and Christianity. So different political parties wore Hindutva cloth. I would say Hindutva is like a cloth. So these political parties, whenever these Hindutva clothes suited them, they wore it. And when they didn't suit them, they took the other cloth out. So similar is the BJP. Right? So people often confuse BJP with Hindutva. BJP is a political party that is wearing the Hindutva ideology for now. But the irony part is there was Congress that has been switching off and on with the Hindutva cloth, like for long. So one of the most powerful prime minister under Congress, she was Indira Gandhi. And if you look at the Indira's second part of power after 1977, she was very comfortably riding on the Hindutva. She wore Hindutva clothes and she was riding on the Hindutva ideology. And that's why when she was murdered in 1984 by two of her Sikhs guard, and there was a large-scale anti-Sikh riot that happened exactly a week before, I mean, these days in 1984, the RSS was leading the genocidal mobs at numerous places.
And last but not least, the harrowing memory of the gang rape of Bill Gasparno and the brutal murder of her family members in Gujarat was refreshed recently with 11 accused men being released by the apex court. Now the question is, do you think the right-wing fanatics enjoy the patronage of the BJP government?
See, the very first thing that they were not released by the apex court. This question was raised in the parliament as to who gave sanction orders for the early release of these convicts. And in the written reply that the minister got, it was clear that the CID of the state was against their release, the Women Commission was against their release, but the Ministry of Home Affairs or the Home Ministry, they gave orders for their early release, not by the apex court. I mean, Bilkis case is one horrendous episode in the Gujarat riots. It was very horrific how 9 or 10 members of a family the women were raped and they were brutally murdered. How one of the convicts, they snatched Bilkis' son and killed the 3-year-old and put in the fire.
There you have it, Mr. Mojtaba, the founder of Miles to Smile Foundation. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see what people have to say on social media.
Human rights lawyer and author Arsalan Iftikhar writes that India is heading down a right-wing rabbit hole led by Hindu nationalist Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who is trying to erase Muslim identity across the country. Ravi Agrawal, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine, quotes from an article by historian Ramachandran Guha on how Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's personality cult will have deeper consequences for the country. Academic researcher Mubashra says Islamophobia is central to the Hindu nationalist movement as it seeks to remake India into a Hindu-only nation, leaving behind over 200 million Muslims.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Since 2014, when the Bharatiya Janata Party came into power in India, the country's 200 million minority Muslims have complained of persecution, hate and violence. At the heart of this majoritarian project have been mosques and monuments and desperate attempts to convert them into Hindu temples. This obnoxious project, vigorously promoted by the Hindu nationalist government, involves rewriting India's history in line with the majoritarian Hindutva ideology by converting mosques and monuments from the medieval era into temples.
While incidents of hate crimes, mob lynching, discriminatory citizenship laws, incarceration of journalists and activists, anti-hijab campaigning, and demolition of Muslim homes and businesses have been the highlight of Narendra Modi's 8 years in power, the campaign to convert Muslim heritage sites into Hindu temples has lately gained momentum. BJP leaders and their ultra-right-wing ideological patrons claim that Muslim Mughal rulers destroyed 36,000 Hindu temples and it was time to reclaim them. From Varanasi's Gyanwapi Mosque to Mathura Shahi Idgah Mosque, Lucknow's Tiliwali Mosque, Bhopal's Jama Masjid, Karnataka's Malali Mosque, a vicious campaign is underway in India to raise down mosques. Historians argue the claims made by BJP leaders are baseless and outlandish, accusing them of inventing a history of their own to serve their political agenda. A series of petitions have been filed by right-wing Hindu groups against mosques across the country in recent months. In Mathura, a city in Uttar Pradesh state, the Shahi Idgah Mosque built by Mughal Emperor Aurangzeb in 1670 alone faces 12 lawsuits. The 17th-century Gyanwapi Mosque in Varanasi is also embroiled in a legal case. Even a world-famous monument, the Taj Mahal, built by Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan, has not escaped litigation, with extremist Hindus claiming it was a Hindu temple containing Hindu relics.
The issue of mosques and Muslim worship has been at the center of BJP's communal politics since it rose to power on the back of a countrywide campaign over the destruction of the 16th-century Babri Masjid in 1992. BJP claimed the mosque was built on the site of the birth of the Hindu god Ram, and its demolition in December 1992 marked a watershed moment in India's post-partition history. In 2019, the country's top court, in a snub to Muslims, handed over the mosque to Hindus.
The 400-year-old Babri Masjid in the small town of Ayodhya in the northern Indian state of Uttar Pradesh was razed to the ground by Hindu fanatics on December 6, 1992. It was estimated that more than 2,000 people died in the orgy of communal violence that swept through the country following the mosque's demolition. 4 years later, in the general election, Bharatiya Janata Party almost doubled its tally in parliament from 85 to 161, using the same Hindutva card. The campaign to build a temple at the disputed site in Ayodhya was later at the center of the party's anti-Muslim riots in Gujarat in 2002, which left more than 1,000 dead, the majority of them Muslims. During the pogrom, Muslim homes and businesses were identified and targeted by Hindu mobs. Hundreds of mosques and shrines were damaged. A medieval-era Muslim shrine in the city of Ahmedabad was razed to the ground. Following the massacre, Modi clinched state elections, proving again that anti-Muslim violence was the party's trump card. After Modi became the prime minister in 2014, the right wing felt emboldened to target mosques, ban the use of loudspeakers for azan, criminalize the wearing of hijab by Muslim women, and stoke communal tensions. Top Muslim political leaders such as Asaduddin Owaisi have drawn similarities between campaigns to convert mosques into temples with Babri Mosque demolition.
Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Zafar Bangash, the director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. Welcome to the program, sir. Now, the BJP's majoritarian project has been centered around converting mosques and monuments into Hindu temples. Now, the question is, does it help the party's political fortunes?
Oh, of course. One of the planks of the BJP and the Hindutva Brigade is that they want to destroy all the mosques in India on the false allegation that these mosques are built on former temples. That's not the case at all. In fact, when Muslims ruled India, Muslim rulers not only protected the Hindu temples, but in many instances, the Muslim rulers actually provided land for the Hindus to build their temples and provided financial support for these temples to be built. Because Islam not only recognizes other religions, but there is a strong projection that Muslims must respect the religious places of other people, even if they disagree with them, as obviously Muslims do with the Hindus, because Hindus are mushriks, they have multiplicity of gods. But Islam prohibits targeting them or destroying their places of worship because this is what Islam enjoins upon its adherents. But we see in India that the BJP has taken launched this campaign to target mosques, destroy them on the false allegation that these mosques stand on the grounds where there used to be temples. Muslims are prohibited from building new mosques, and when they can't find places such as mosques to pray, when the Muslims come out to pray outside, then the Hindus attack them there as well. There have been many, many instances in which Muslims have been attacked while they have been praying. So this right-wing fascist ideology that is raging throughout India has targeted the mosques in particular as well, because mosques are seen as symbols of religious identity for the Muslims. So this is part and parcel of the Hindu ideology, and by whipping up anti-Muslim sentiment among the majority of Hindus, the BJP tries to cash in on that vote, and since they constitute an absolute majority in India, when out of 1.2 or 1.3 billion people in India, Muslims are about 200 million, the Christians are probably about 20 million or so, and although the Dalits are about 200 million, but they have also been incorporated into the Hindu religion, despite the fact that the Dalits are discriminated against viciously.
Mr. Ghosh, BJP leaders claim that Mughal rulers destroyed thousands of Hindu temples and made mosques. Now, does this claim carry any weight in the light of historical records?
Yes, indeed. The demolition of Babri Mosque back in December of 1992 was a watershed moment in the history of Muslims in India. Now, that mosque in Ayodhya was built by the Mughal Emperor Babur in 1528. And Babur, of course, was a Mughal ruler. And the Hindus claimed that the Babri Mosque was built on a place where the Hindu god Ram was born. But it's interesting to note that there are two other places in the same city, Ayodhya, where the Hindus claim that their god Ram was born.